Okay, so Isaiah 40, verses 18 to 26. With whom then will you compare God? To what image will you liken him? As for an idol, a metal worker casts it, and a goldsmith overlays it with gold and fashions silver chains for it. A person too poor to present such an offering selects wood that will not rot. They will look for a skilled worker to set up an idol that will not topple. Do you not know? Have you not heard? Has it not been told you from the beginning? Have you not understood since the earth was founded? He sits enthroned above the circle of the earth, and its people are like grasshoppers. He stretches out the heavens like a canopy and spreads out like a tent to live in. He brings princes to naught and reduces the rulers of this world to nothing. No sooner are they planted, no sooner are they sown, no sooner do they take root in the ground, then he blows on them and they wither, and a whirlwind sweeps them away like chaff. To whom will you compare me, or who is my equal, says the Holy One. Lift up your eyes and look to the heavens. Who created all these? He who brings out the starry host one by one and calls forth each of them by name. Because of his great power and mighty strength, not one of them is missing. Then down to 1 Corinthians 15, verses 3 to 9. For what I received as of first importance, that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day according to the Scriptures, and that he appeared to Cephas and then to 12. After that, he appeared to more than 500 of the brothers and sisters at the same time, most of whom are still living, but some have fallen asleep. Then he appeared to James, then to all the apostles, and last of all, he appeared to me also, as to one abnormally born. For I am the least of the apostles and do not even deserve to be called an apostle, because I persecuted the church of God.
Hey, wouldn't it be great to be a kid for a day, right? You know, to see the world through their eyes. I love questions that the kids ask. I'm fascinated by the questions that I asked when I was a kid. When I was four, I was sitting in the back of the car with my little baby brother. He was a few months old. Mum was reversing, so I thought it'd be a good time to ask her a question. And I said, "Mum, when you were mating, were you careful? When you were mating, were you careful?" I can't even imagine what Mum was thinking at the time. She said to me, "You know, what do you mean by that, Michael?" I didn't know all the mechanics of sex, but I knew it had something to do with eggs. And so I said to Mum, "When you were mating, were you careful not to break the eggs? Because if you break the eggs, you would have had twins." There you go. I can't wait till our little girl Elle starts asking questions like that. Wouldn't you love to be a kid for a day, to be inside their brain, have their sense of wonder and curiosity? And for a bunch of years, I've gone into schools, to primary schools, and taught kids scripture, and taught them about what Christianity is. And I love it. And I love the fact they're often really skeptical. They're really curious. They ask lots of questions. One of the biggest questions I hear time and time again is, who made God? If God is real, who made God? It's a fascinating question, and one I think that captures a deep desire, a deep sense of wonder in all of us. So how do we know that God really exists? It's this question that culture, philosophers, scientists, bloggers, even meme artists have been writing a great deal about. It polled actually second highest in the community survey that perhaps a bunch of you got involved in. Today, it sort of seems crazy, right, to believe that God exists. I mean, where's the evidence? There was a comedian, George Carlin. He says that religion has actually convinced people that there's an invisible man living in the sky who watches everything you do every minute of the day. Prominent atheist Sam Harris, he says that the fact that nearly half the American population apparently believes in God purely on the basis of religious dogma should be considered a moral and intellectual emergency. Pretty serious. But regardless of actually if you believe in God or not, it's the biggest question you'll ever face in life. Why? Because the consequences are so important. See, if there's no God, if this life here on earth is all there is, then this will drastically shape how we live. We live only a short number of years to leave a legacy, to achieve our hopes and our dreams. Maybe that's building a family. Maybe it's starting a business that can impact the lives of people. Or maybe it's just sitting back, relaxing, enjoying the years you have. And religion, you know, ain't nobody got time for that. I mean, sure, go to church, you know, get that sense of belonging, but don't get too involved. See, if God doesn't exist, definitely don't give the church any money. But on the other hand, if there is God, if there really is more to life than just here, if there really is a great power that we can somehow interact with and even know, what if there's an afterlife? What if heaven is real? Man, don't you want to be doing everything possible to make sure you're there? Make sure those you love are there. Imagine if you are just diagnosed, this might be heavy for some of us, if you're diagnosed with cancer, this is true for some of you guys I know, you know people like this as well, wouldn't you want to know that if there was a slight evidence out there for a cure, if there was the slight chance, wouldn't you want to know that? There's an atheist, an entertainer, he's actually a magician, his name's Penn Jillette, and he gets this, he understands why this question is so important, what's at stake. He says he actually doesn't respect Christians who don't want to share their faith. He says, how much do you have to hate somebody to believe that everlasting life is possible and not tell them that? So he's an atheist, right? He gets it. He gets that nothing else is more important. If God really does exist, if heaven's real, that's got huge implications. No question is more important than life. It's more important than who you marry, more important than if you have kids, what job you have. It's even more important than whether pineapple belongs on pizza or not. It does, by the way, just in case you're wondering. But this question, does God exist? It's something that you can't sit on the fence. We can't just bury our head in the sand and ignore it. We all have to deal with it. And because it's such a massive question, I'm not going to pretend in the next 20 minutes or so that I'm going to be able to solve it for us. But my goal is to show that how believing in God is not only reasonable, but there actually is good evidence behind it. And so we're going to look this morning at three types of evidence: science, morality, and history. And I'll wrap up by showing in particular how there's evidence not just for a God, but for the Christian God of the Bible. As Garnet said, there'll be time for questions as well. If you've got a booklet, there's a number you can text just in there. So feel free to text questions as we go along. But the first piece of evidence that we're going to look at is science. And so you might be thinking, science? Mike, why are you bringing that up? You know, science disproves God. And if you've got faith, what you're doing is you're sort of leaving your brain at the door. You're ignoring all this scientific discovery that we've made over the past few hundred years. You know, I saw someone on Facebook this week post, I'm actually embarrassed to have been gullible enough to once believed in God. I posted that this week. You know, back in the Middle Ages, you know, people believed in God, but that was before we knew that the world was round. You know, back then we thought the earth was the center of the universe, and we couldn't even understand disease. You know, when someone got a mental illness, we sort of said, oh, they probably got a demon, something like that. And if we didn't understand something, we just said, God did it, back in the Middle Age. But now, due to science, we don't need to put that childish, we can put that childish thinking behind. James Watson, who was a molecular biologist, he was the head of the Human Genome Project, he said this. He said, the biggest advantage to believing in God is that you don't have to understand anything. No physics, no biology. I wanted to understand. So now, because of science, through physics, chemistry, biology, we can explain. We can close these gaps. You might have heard that thinking before, but you might be surprised that actually there's a huge number of modern-day scientists who not only strengthened their faith through studying science, but actually became Christians. Francis Collins, who actually took over James Watson's job as the head of the Human Genome Project, he's one of the top scientific minds of our world. He became a Christian at age 27 after studying his second PhD. He was a staunch atheist at college, but he said that as a scientist, he wanted to examine the evidence and see where that led him. He said, I began to realize that the evidence for existing of God, while not proof, was actually pretty interesting and certainly made me realize that atheism would no longer be for me an acceptable choice. And it was the least rational of the options. So what's this evidence that he's talking about? What evidence does science give us? One of the gaping holes in science is the explaining the origin of the universe. Collins, he says that even as a scientist, I had to admit that we had no idea how the universe got started. So, you know, prior to the 20th century, scientists thought that the universe had always existed. It had always existed. And about 100 years ago came along the Big Bang Theory. The Big Bang Theory. Is anyone sad that Big Bang Theory show's been cancelled? Yeah, thanks, babes. Yeah, there we go. We can console each other later. It's a bit emotional. Now, not that Big Bang Theory. The Big Bang scientific theory came along that said that actually the universe did have an origin. You know, back in 927, it was actually put forward by a Catholic priest called Georges Lemaître, if I've got that correctly. He was a French guy, and he actually said that the universe actually had an origin. And scientists rejected it at the time. You know, atheists rejected this Big Bang theory at the time because they thought it sounded too Christian. They thought, no, only crazy religious people believe that the universe had a beginning. The universe has always existed. That's just common scientific thinking. You know, the first line of the Bible, in the book of Genesis, it says, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." If the universe had a beginning, what caused its beginning? If it was this hot ball of energy when the entire universe could fit inside a football, and then in a second expanded to billions of kilometers, which is that's sort of what the Big Bang Theory is saying. What caused that to happen? You know, in science, we see that everything that comes into existence has an explanation. You know, a tree, it doesn't just pop into existence. It starts off with a seed, which comes from another tree, which came from another tree. In the same way, the universe, it kind of just popped into existence. There had to be something to cause it, to explain its existence. Well, to sum up, whatever begins to exist has to have a cause. The universe begins to exist, therefore the universe has a cause. Scientists, they have no idea what caused it. I want to suggest that the most likely cause is a personal creator, God. Do you know how improbable, how unlikely it is for the universe to even exist? It's like the conditions had to be fine-tuned just so precisely. Stephen Hawking, who maybe a bunch of you know of, he was perhaps one of the greatest thinkers of the last 100 years, a prominent atheist, an astrophysicist. He said that if the rate of expansion of the universe were off during the Big Bang by even one part in 100,000,000,000,000, it's a big number, one part in 100,000,000,000,000, the universe as we know it would not exist. The universe would not exist if it was off by just one part. He says the odds of against the universe like ours emerging out of something like the Big Bang, I think there are clearly religious implications. It would be very difficult to explain why the universe would have begun in just this way, except as the act of God who intended to create beings like us. Fascinating. One of the most brilliant minds of the last 100 years. You know, I tried reading a book that he wrote, A Brief History of Time. I was kind of reading it, and I just finished the page, and I was like, what even did I just read? Has anyone had experience reading a book before like that? Yeah. He's a brilliant guy. And this is what he says. He's an atheist, and yet this is what he comes to after studying the universe. It's incredible. The universe is so improbable. What's even more improbable than the universe existing is the conditions of life emerging. You know, there are around 50 variables, you know, the force of gravity, the Earth's proximity to the sun, a whole bunch of others that need to be so precise that if any of them were off just slightly, life would not exist. John Polkinghorne, he's the professor of physics at Cambridge, he says the probability of life on Earth forming is like an archer aiming at a target 2 centimeters wide, standing at one end of the universe, aiming at this 2 centimeter target at the other end of the universe. I don't know if anyone's done archery before. I've done it a couple of times. I'm just stoked if I can hit the target like 10 meters away. Went to a rifle shooting range once. It wasn't that good. Thankfully, no one got hurt. But a target 2 centimeters wide, one end of the universe, hitting the other end of the universe. If you're off, just you can't even imagine how exact that is. Another illustration, you know, sometimes I have guys around for poker when my wife lets me. I know if you want to give me a Father's Day gift, babe, you know, feel free to let me have another poker night with the boys. But anyway, sometimes I have guys around for poker, and it's fun. And You know, if you know about poker, there's different types of poker, but four aces. If you've got four aces, that's a virtually unbeatable hand, right? Imagine you come around to my house for poker. I deal myself, I've got four aces. You'd be like, okay, Mike, you're pretty lucky, you're a bit suspicious. Imagine I kept dealing, we're playing 20, 30 games, I kept getting four aces. You'd be like, what's going on, Mike? I'm leaving, you're clearly cheating, this is wrong, I'm going to leave your house right now. I lose my friends, I keep dealing, and I keep dealing four aces hundreds and hundreds of times in a row. What are the chances of that happening? That's so improbable. That's the same improbability we're talking about when we're talking about the origin of life. You know, in a game like that, a poker, you'd have to say it was rigged. In the same way, when looking at the conditions of the universe, of life, surely there must be someone behind it. And what's even more amazing, I think, is actually looking around at the human body, looking around at us. This is an incredible piece of scientific evidence. You know, we start off as a sperm and an egg and we form a human body. Isn't that amazing? You know, December 12 last year, I saw for the first time, face to face, my daughter, Elle. It was an incredible moment. Incredible moment when I saw that. I'm sure mums and dads, brothers and sisters, when you saw your kid for the first time, what a moment that is. Our bodies, they're so incredibly complex. We have systems that can fight diseases, heal cuts. Our fingerprints, they're all unique. Our DNA, it's all unique. Do you know if you stretched out a single person's DNA, it could go to the moon and back 5,000 times? It's crazy, right? You have individual faces, personalities, desires, hopes, aspirations. And there's 200 or so people in this room. You're all unique. There's 7 billion of you in the world. And while there's a common thread of humanity, not one of you is the same. Let me ask you this. Which takes more faith? That the blind forces of science of evolution have brought us here this far, or there's an intelligence behind it all? Imagine for a sec you're in the Glasshouse Mountains going for a bushwalk. And suddenly you find an iPhone X. You just find an iPhone X, just like that, right? You know, you're a bit lost and you're off track and you see it, right? And it's actually got some battery life left. And you press it and it's unlocked for some reason. And you wouldn't just say, oh, yeah, that's probably just been there for 300 years. It probably just kind of came from the iPhone 6 tree. It came from the iPhone 5 tree. You wouldn't say that, right? You wouldn't say that. Yeah, sure, you could talk about the evolution of the iPhone, how it came originally from the Nokia 3310. Remember them? Indestructible. You could just smash them. They'd bounce back up. You could say that. But actually, that would be silly, right? To just say that, to say it evolved naturally over time. You know, there was a designer. There was Steve Jobs and Tim Cook and the team from Apple. And there was, you know, assembly processors, software engineers. It didn't just happen to be. And yet something far more complex than the iPhone X, far more unique, is sitting right next to you. A human being with trillions of cells, with intricate systems communicating messages, blood and oxygen to the extremities of your body. What's more likely, that we just came into existence or that there's an intelligence behind it? In the Bible, there's a song, a Psalm 139, and it says, King David, he's the author of it, he says, the beauty of God's handiwork. He says that you made all the delicate inner parts of my body. Talking to God, you knit me together in my mother's womb. Thank you for making me so wonderfully complex. I love this picture of God knitting together people in their mother's womb. It's poetry, but he's talking about what God is doing with these incredible scientific processes behind, where this tiny person starts off as a sperm and egg and forms a human being. This picture of a beautiful artist, a designer behind it all. All right, so this is the scientific evidence. That was my longest point, my most nerdy point, so if you're kind of tuned out, that's okay, hang in. Next point, morality. This will be a bit quicker. So we've seen the scientific world. It's plausible to believe there's an intelligence behind it, but let's turn to morality. Are there objective moral values? Is there really a sense of right and wrong? Or is it up to each culture to decide? Now, it sort of seems racist, right, if we impose our moral values on another culture? That doesn't seem right. Now, a few years ago, my cousin, he got married in Poland. And while I was over there in Poland, I thought I would take the opportunity to go to Auschwitz. Auschwitz, the Nazi prison camp where over a million people were killed. Most of them were Jews in the gas chambers. And you walk through this big sign saying, Arbeit macht frei, which means work will make you free. A blatant lie from the Nazi propaganda machine. That if you work, you can be free. If you work in this camp, you can find free. And one of the things that stayed with me, and I still wince at the thought, is you walk in to Auschwitz and you see this huge room full of human hair. Full of human hair. There were people that died during World War II. Children that were waiting to wish their father Happy Father's Day. Parents that were trying to work hard to provide for their kids. Teenagers that were asking big questions of life. People that had real stories. And even though I'd studied this stuff in high school, there was something powerfully raw about what was going on when I experienced it firsthand. You couldn't help but feel this sadness, followed by this anger. How could this happen? This is not right. And I'm sure that any of you who have been there or that will go there would be feeling the same. Why is that? Is it just because our culture tells us that it's wrong? Or is it through evolution that we've come to a point where valuing human life has enabled us to survive? Is this where we get our morality from? Richard Dawkins, who's perhaps the most famous atheist in the world, he's an evolutionary biologist. He says this: there is, at the bottom, no design, no purpose, no evil, no good. Nothing but pointless indifference. We are machines for propagating DNA. It is every living object's sole reason for being. Does this atheistic worldview seem convincing? You know, Hitler and the Nazi ideology, they were greatly influenced by evolutionary thinking. They twisted it, yes, but it's called social Darwinism. But in a quest to produce the superhuman, they thought they could speed up this process of natural selection by wiping out, in their minds, inferior people. We all react to that. We all say that's wrong. But why? There's something innate inside of us that knows that's evil. You can't just kill innocent people because you think that you're better than them. You know, these values, they're not just a cultural thing. They're transcendent to the human race. Surely murdering children is wrong, regardless of what regimes say. This deep sense of right and wrong, it comes from outside of us. It has to come from an intelligence outside of us. See, if there is an objective moral law, there has to be an objective moral law giver. There has to be someone who's, by their standard, somehow can determine right and wrong. But if there is no God, then who are we to say what is good and what is evil? That things like Richard Dawkins are just are. I don't know if you like watching animal fights. I love it. You know, even if they have sort of clickbait images like this. But, you know, in the animal kingdom, a lot, you know, there's an elephant fighting a rhino, which often that happens. But, you know, you just sort of say that's normal. Or, you know, the documentary, The Lion King, the lion eats the antelope. You know, it's all just part of the great circle of life, right? But, you know, we don't accuse lions of being murderers. If there's no God, how can we say that killing humans is evil? Listen to what the Bible says. Listen to what the Christian God hates from the book of Proverbs. He says, "The Lord hates proud eyes, a lying tongue, and hands that kill those who aren't guilty. He also hates hearts that make evil plans and feet that are quick to do evil. He hates any witness who pours out lies and anyone who stirs up conflict in the community." See, reading the Bible, there's this clear picture of right and wrong because each human life is sacred. Each person is created with dignity, with purpose, with value. Each person is created in the image of God. See, God hates it when things are subverted. He hates injustice. God hates that, you know, right now there's 40 million slaves in the world, more than any other time in history. And there's a few thousand, they reckon, in Australia. God hates that. He hates when people are taken advantage of, forced into sex slavery, into factories where they work seven days a week, 14 hours a day. He hates the fact that in Australia, one woman a week dies from domestic violence. If there's no God, we can't call these things objectively bad. They just are. They're bad because of their effects, because they hurt our progress, which again is a subjective term. If there's no God, what basis is there for right and wrong? Objective good does exist. Therefore, moral values and duties have to exist. Therefore, there must be a giver of moral duties. So by looking at the universe and looking at morality, what's more likely, blind forces or a higher power? But which higher power? And let me wrap up with this. This is our final point. This leads us to the historical evidence. There's so much to say here, but I'm going to focus on Jesus. Did he rise from the dead? If Jesus didn't rise from the dead, then Christianity is a complete waste of time. But if he did, it changes everything. It means there's more to life. Firstly, just did he even exist? You know, Richard Dawkins, again, sorry to pick on him, but in his book, The God Delusion, he says that it's even possible to mount a serious, though not widely supported, historical case that Jesus never existed at all, as has been done by, among others, Professor G.A. Wells at the University of London. You might have heard this stuff before, that Jesus probably didn't exist, you know, it's probably a myth. This sort of sounds pretty credible. He's quoting a professor. He's even doing the fancy thing of using his initials, not his full name. That sounds pretty smart. But you know the problem here? This guy, G.A. Wells, he's actually a professor in German studies. Not in history, not in biblical studies, not in religion. German studies. You know, it'd be sort of like if you're sick, going to see the captain of the Broncos to find out what's wrong with you. You know, like maybe you get an autograph, maybe make you feel better, but he's not going to actually deal with your sickness, right? You know, he's way out of his field. There's no serious historian out there that denies Jesus existed. Dr. Bart Ehrman, he's a very anti-Christian, actually. He's a historian. He says this isn't even an issue for scholars in history. The reason for thinking Jesus existed is because he's abundantly attested in early sources. If you want to go where the evidence goes, I think that atheists have done themselves a disservice by jumping on the bandwagon of mythicism because, frankly, it makes you look foolish to the outside world. If that's what you're going to believe, you just look foolish. You know, historians, they can prove Jesus existed without even using the Bible. You know, ancient historians such as the Jewish Josephus refer to him as a wise man. There's a Tacitus, Roman historian, again, not a Christian. He testifies that Jesus was killed under the governor Pontius Pilate. You can ask about this later, but there's a whole bunch of other non-Christian ancient historians, should pop up on the screen, that talk about Jesus outside the Bible. When I first realized that, I was like, wow, that's pretty amazing. I thought the Bible was just kind of this Christian thing that Jesus sort of was made up. I was blown away by this evidence. But then, of course, moving beyond what non-Christian sources say, what does actually the Bible say? And you might be thinking, hang on, Mike, you can't use the Bible to prove Jesus existed. That's cheating. You cheat at poker. Now you're trying to cheat at history. What's going on here? Well, I'll concede that the documents have bias. The Bible, yes, it is biased, but actually every single document ever written in history is biased. There's no such thing as an objective history. You know, everything that's written has a purpose for it, a reason for it. Otherwise, why would you write it? But actually, you might be surprised how seriously ancient historians take the New Testament. Do you know there's three main criteria about how reliable history is? It's the number of copies we have, the closeness the closeness of these copies to the original events, and actually how much they vary. If you have a look at the handout I gave you that you should have received on the way in, it still looks a bit like a solar system. I'll explain what this is. You see there's these small yellow circles on the right. And what they represent is kind of other ancient documents that we have. There's Caesar's works kind of on the bottom right there. It's got number 251. What that's saying is that we have 251 ancient copies of Caesar's history. 251. And historians go, yeah, that's pretty good. It's pretty good we got 251. And actually, if you look how far away it is from the center, there's a table on the left, 950 years, the first copies we have to the events that took place. Historians go, yeah, that's not too bad because we've got so many copies. That's pretty good. Compare that to the New Testament. Look how much bigger the red circle is on the left. We've got nearly 6,000 copies or fragments of the New Testament written in the original language. If you add other languages like Latin, Syriac, there's nearly 18,000 copies. And if you compare the proximity, the closeness to the center there, the earliest documents we have were just 40 years after Jesus, perhaps even less. You know, the New Testament's got bigger circles than any other ancient document because we've got more surviving copies. But also, you might be thinking, well, maybe there's Chinese whispers. Maybe they've changed over time. They reckon that actually, historians reckon there's only about 2% of variance between any of these copies. So it means if you look at any of these early copies, only 2% variance. And of those variances, only 2% of them actually make a difference. So most of them are just sort of spelling mistake. You know, people forgetting to, you know, cross the I's and dot the T's or whatever it is you do with your spelling. But so 2% of 2%, so that's 1 in 1,000. So basically 99.9% of these copies match up is basically what that's saying. You can chat to me about that later, ask questions. But flick over the page you got and look at the reading that Kerry read for us, 1 Corinthians 15. This is a document written to a real church in Greece about maybe even less than 40 years, perhaps even as early as 20 years after Jesus. But actually, it's referring to events in the past. Paul, the writer, he says, "For what I received, I passed on to you as first importance, that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day according to the Scriptures." See, Paul, he's writing maybe at most 40 years after, but he's talking about events that had already taken place. He's talking about a tradition that people already knew about, which points us even closer to the center circle. You know, with a generation of Jesus' life, there had already been a tradition that Jesus did rise from the dead. And so this is the biggest convincing evidence, that the evidence for Jesus' resurrection. Very quickly, there are three historical facts which I believe give us great evidence for Jesus' resurrection. Firstly, the empty tomb. Now, the earliest sources of Jesus' death, recorded in Matthew, Mark, and Luke's biographies of Jesus, do you know what they say? They say the first eyewitnesses of Jesus, of the empty tomb, sorry, were women. He said that women were the first ones to see the empty tomb. That might not sound particularly surprising to you, but back then, that culture was very different, very different. You know, women, their testimony was not valid in the court of law. You know, ladies, if you witnessed me stab someone, if I went and stabbed Jimmy and you saw it and there were no blokes in the room, do you know what? I'd get off scot-free back then. That's just how things worked. That's how things worked because women, their testimony wasn't valid. So if you were going to start a conspiracy, if you were going to kind of make up this thing that actually Jesus' tomb was empty, you wouldn't get women as your go-to girls to spread this story. Not because the Bible was sexist, in fact, if anything, the opposite, but just the culture. That's what the culture was like back then. Secondly, second piece of evidence is that the eyewitnesses said they saw the resurrected Jesus. Again, that Bible reading that from 1 Corinthians, we see Paul who's writing, he claims that real people like Cephas, which is Peter, James, the brother of Jesus, the 12 apostles, and 500 others, many of whom are still alive, saw the resurrected Jesus. You know, basically he's saying that there's this account of Jesus' resurrection. You guys, you already know about it, Corinthian church, and the witnesses are still alive. So you can actually go and ask them. You can actually go check it out for yourself if you don't believe it. In fact, Paul even includes his life on that. In Paul, he says that I saw Jesus. Paul, his life was changed so drastically. He was basically a religious extremist going out killing Christians. He says that at the end. That's why he called himself, I'm the least of the apostles. He was killing Christians, and yet he became so convinced that he saw Jesus that he actually ended up being the greatest missionary we've ever seen.
He became one. And so if Jesus didn't rise from the dead, why are there so many witnesses claiming that he did? But thirdly, how can we explain the origin of the Christian faith? You know, we know from history that at least 10 of the 12 apostles, they were killed for their faith. Paul, who was clearly an intelligent guy, he was beaten, he was thrown in jail multiple times for believing this stuff. What motive did the early Christians have for spreading this if it was all a lie, if it was fake news? And within a couple of hundred years, Christianity had spread from just a few dozen people to over millions, from Britain to even India to Northern Africa, all with pretty primitive technology. So, did Jesus actually rise from the dead? I believe the most logical explanation, which takes the least amount of blind faith, is actually that he really is the Son of God, that he really did rise from the dead. Which means that if this is true, we too can rise from the dead and have eternal life. Of course, you've got to make your mind up for yourself. But for me personally, just like Dave and Grant, I was convinced of the evidence. You know, when I was at university, I checked out a bunch of this historical stuff. This seemed overwhelmingly convincing for me. But more than that, as these guys mentioned before, I had experiences. When I prayed to God, when I realized that actually God had sent his son Jesus to die for me, that I didn't have to try and prove myself before him. I didn't have to be good to get into heaven. Now, Grant described himself as a rat bag. I'd probably use a worse adjective than that when I was in my late teens. But God saved me. I didn't have to prove myself. I felt like this massive weight came off my shoulders because of God's love for me in Jesus.